Shimen, welcome to Waterstones.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really thrilled to talk to you about the chain, but I'm also slightly wary because it's a very powerful and painful book to read. And it's really difficult to know where to start. So if you don't mind, I'm going to start where you start.
Sure, makes sense.
The book starts with you going to an abortion clinic. And yeah. I wondered if you could maybe just give us a little background as to how you found yourself there. And I suppose the mental state you were in when you were there. I realise that's a very big question, but...
Yeah. So I mean, it starts with me meeting this person who I thought was, you know, a committed partner. And then we make a decision through various reasons that become apparent quite early on in the book that it's not the right time. And Planned Parenthood, I think, is still a thing in New York. It's hard to say at this point, but that was generally when you speak to girlfriends, it was like, it's a good place, it's a safe place. And there was one in Queens that had one of the soonest appointments, nearest appointments, and I was living in Brooklyn at the time. Mm. And the book starts with me making my way there and then everything unraveling. I don't know what my headspace was at the time. I think you feel kind of numb, I guess. You just sort of accept that it's a decision that you've made and that you have to go with it, and then you'll deal with whatever happens afterwards. Mm. But I never experienced anything like that before in my life. And then I didn't really get to grieve the thing that I wanted to grieve, because as the book then goes into, it just sort of unravels into chaos after that. So multiple things had to be grieved and processed after, and not just kind of that very normal decision that so many people find themselves making.
Yeah, as you said, so a lot of women will have been through exactly what you've been through. They've gone to have an abortion, which is a difficult enough thing to deal with.
Yeah.
But when you come out from that appointment, the partner, as you say, who you thought was a committed partner, has literally...
vanished.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how to begin to approach this, but that must, the shock doesn't really even cover it. It must have just taken over everything.
Yeah, it doesn't play out like a memory to me. It plays out almost like a movie scene.
Yeah.
Like it didn't make sense at the time, and it still doesn't make sense. And in a weird way, that kind of has become a coping mechanism, that I don't really see it as one of like my memories. I see it as just like this clip from this like crazy like thriller almost.
Yeah.
And that kind of over time has made it easier to process. I couldn't even tell you what my thoughts were at the time, because it was just, yeah, like you said, shock doesn't even really cover it. I couldn't really piece together what was going on. It was kind of frantic and quite manic, I think.
I think even logically, if you came out from someone like that and you were expecting to see your partner and they weren't there, so then you'd go through the logical things like, oh, maybe they've gone somewhere else, maybe I'll meet them somewhere else.
Yeah.
But you go through all of that, you go back to your apartment, his stuff has gone.
Yeah.
When was the point at which you realised that there was no logical explanation, that it was something...
So I definitely knew that he was gone before I left the clinic, because I went through all those steps of where is he, where could he be, and then realised that my number was blocked and that I was blocked across all social media, and then that's when it becomes really apparent that this isn't someone who's just gone to the bathroom or he's gone to get a snack from a bodega or whatever, that this is someone who's kind of calculated their disappearance. But I don't really think even by the time I get back to my apartment, even sort of the days afterwards, I don't think there was any logic. I don't really know how I dealt with it. I think you have to sit with it for a while. And nothing was making sense. I remember constantly like retelling the story to myself or retelling the story to a friend, or to whoever I could like get in touch with, like ringing friends in London and being like, I can't, and none of us could make sense of it. You know, no matter how many times I tried to explain the details of that day or the day before or the week before, none of it could add up.
When did it start to make sense? Was it when you saw this social media post on Instagram?
Yeah, that's when it all fell into place.
I can't even begin to imagine what it was like, because the picture was of his face.
Face, yeah. And yeah, a drawing of his face by another woman, drawn by another woman.
So presumably a huge shock to see that face again.
Yeah, but a huge relief.
Right.
But like a huge relief, because I was like, okay, this is it. It made sense to me then. I was like, I knew that if I reached out to her that some of the pieces of the jigsaw would be would be put into, but I didn't think it was going to unravel the way that it did. I didn't think that I would get as many answers as I did. But suddenly it made sense that it was like, okay, this wasn't someone who had a mental breakdown or someone who, I didn't even know what I thought it could have been by that point. But suddenly I knew as soon as I saw that illustration that I was like, okay, I'm going to get something out of this. And it was a relief, actually. But there had been a few months by that point.
Yeah. This post was a woman trying to warn other women about this man and his behaviour.
Yeah.
And what then happened was that the comments got filled with other women who had the same experience, including you.
Yes.
Were you ever surprised to see how many women had been affected by this one person?
No, weirdly not. I think it started slow at one point, and then it sort of took off. And I think by the time I'd gauged what kind of person he was and I'd heard some other stories, it did make sense that there would be as many victims, I guess, for want of a better word, as there were. I don't necessarily think that I thought that they'd all come together in one place the way that it did, but I'm not surprised that there were that many women, because people who abuse like him, the stories that I did know, it was obvious that, you know, it was a pattern and that he was committed to doing that.
You mentioned that it was actually several months between your when he left and when you saw that post.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in the book that in that time you realise that you say that you have done half the work for him in making excuses and sort of allowing him to feel that you were the problem.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that headspace? Because it seems to me that's such a crucial part of his approach and this idea, I suppose, of coercive control.
Well, the thing is, it's his approach, because I think in a lot of ways it's society's approach.
Yeah.
You know, you're consistently told, I think especially as women, that you know, you need to make constant allowances for your partners, for your kids, for your job, for the system generally in place. Appreciate it happens to men too, in some very similar ways and other different ways. So it's not always gendered. But there is a thing that happens where I think women, even when we're like young girls, we're always told you're not good enough, you know, and that you should be really grateful and that everything is sort of geared towards having a husband, being a mother, having a family, doing these things. And that will answer all of your questions at the end of it. And it becomes this ultimate goal almost at our own expense.
Mm-hmm.
And without us necessarily having the tools to kind of look at when it's right and when it isn't and what's healthy and what isn't. And we sort of, I think society kind of teaches you to gaslight yourself quite a lot. You see it quite a lot. There's this joke on TikTok where there's this sort of, I don't know, they're like tarot readers. Mm-hmm. And they keep popping up. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They keep popping up in between, like, well, I scroll through mostly to look at cats. But they'll like, they'll pop up every so often and they'll be like, the man that left you, that was cheating on you, he's going to come back to you. And It's this constant manipulation where you're constantly making excuses for things that you've left and partners that you've walked away from for the right reasons, or people who've walked away from you that you should never go back to.
Yeah.
But that you're constantly fooling yourself into being like, oh, well, he cheated on me because he was really stressed at work, or, you know, he doesn't, the whole weaponized incompetence thing. It's like, oh, he doesn't do the dishes because he grew up in a house where his mum used to do it for him. Or he punched a hole in the wall because he's tired and he had an argument with his mum, or his grandma died. Or just constant abusive behaviours that we're taught to justify at our own expense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, that's what I meant by that I did half the work for him, because every bad behaviour that he displayed, every red flag, so to speak, I made an excuse for in my head. I gave him the way out before he even gave me the way out, you know.
Once you found these other women who'd been affected in the same way to you, in fact, actually, you say that you found yourself comparing your experience to theirs.
Yeah.
Again, sort of examining how much of it was your fault, or had he done the same, had he treated you worse? Because you're quite self-critical throughout this book. And sort of...
Yeah, not just through the book, yeah, just generally, yeah. But again, I think that's taught. I think a lot of women do that. I think a lot of men do that too. I think we are sort of taught to think that everything's our fault and that we're the problem and that we're not good enough. And I mean, it's you know, I was born in the 80s, so I grew up in particular with that 90s magazine culture of, you know, how Bridget Jones, I can't remember the actress's name now, what was her name?
Renee Zellweger. Yeah.
How that was meant to be fat. Not that there's anything wrong with being fat. Fat people are incredibly beautiful. Skinny people are incredibly beautiful. But the idea that that was considered to be an unhealthy body when she was like a actually really thin woman, and that magazine culture of like heroin chic and all of that. So constantly, the Heat magazine circle of shame, where they'd, you know, a woman would have a tiny sweat patch underneath her t-shirt walking through the streets, and there'd be that massive circle around it in the middle of the magazine. And we grew up with that, and I'm sure that's still happening now. I don't know, I'm not really reading into sort of, I'm not 17 anymore, so I don't really understand what pop culture looks like now. But certainly for us growing up, it was, you were constantly taught to find what's wrong with you and try and improve on it. And then you improve on it and it's still wrong. And I think that's where that mindset comes from, unfortunately.
With the sort of women that you met through this post, there obviously becomes this fantastic support network in a way by sharing your stories. And in a sort of a slightly rare moment, I suppose, of humour in the book, there's this brilliant thing which you refer to as the sisterhood of the travelling pull-up, which is where he had stolen things from various people or taken them from house to house, and you started to reunite each other with your belongings.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that.
That was really funny. The pull-up bar that goes missing from one girl's house, and then everybody gets gifted to another woman who doesn't know how to use the pull-up bar. So it's kind of going from house to house and it's very unused. There were lots of things that we all started to clock. And then at certain points where you realise that, oh, actually, if he gave me a gift, chances are, if I text this group, this will belong to someone in the group. And yes, it always did. Everyone, I think to my knowledge, everyone got their stuff back, or they went, oh, doesn't worry. Don't worry about it. You keep it. Mm. I kind of had to be funny by that point, I think, you know, and I think we needed to have that comic relief by that point and make each other laugh. And I remember it actually being quite a joyous time. I remember there was a lot of laughter. Yeah. There was more laughter than there were tears by that point. Yeah. I remember there was a lot of humour. They were a funny group. They really were.
One of the lines of the book, you say that there is a fearlessness about the way women love each other.
Yeah.
That's sort of what you're talking about, isn't it? That support.
Yeah, there kind of has to be, I think. I think we don't have a system that looks after us, and we don't have a police force that perhaps are only really starting to now engage with how women are feeling sort of post Sarah Everard. We're still in a culture of not believing rape victims and not believing women who suffer domestic violence. And you see it quite a lot. People don't want to believe that their male friends or their brothers that they love are capable of doing that. I've never seen him behave like that. I've never seen him hurt a fly. Doesn't mean that who he is with you or who he is with his colleagues doesn't mean that's who that person is, that man is, with their partners or their children even. And I think because of that, women kind of, we've had to create our own network, because there isn't really there's scarcely a legal system in place, and there isn't really a wider societal system put into place that believes us or trusts us or looks after us. So we kind of have to do it for each other. I think you're brought up knowing how to do that, and it becomes almost quite intuitive and quite instinctive. And I really love it. There's something quite coded, you know. There's a certain look that you give each other. So it was something I noticed the other day about this woman who clocked this young girl being harassed by a man in the street, and she went up to her and she was like, she referred to herself as her auntie, I think, and she was like, oh, it's so great to see you, like, oh, I've been waiting for you, like, come this way with me, I've got the car around the corner, because she picked, I mean, there were strangers, but she picked up on the fact that this young girl was in a vulnerable situation. And women are just very good, I think, generally, we're very good at instinctively kind of knowing how to read the room, because, well, we know what to look for because it's happened to us our whole lives. So we see it when it happens to others.
You mentioned earlier about how men will often refer to their friends and their awareness or otherwise of what they're like. You actually spoke to some of his friends in order to try and understand, and were surprised to find that the thing that they were shocked about was the fact that he had sort of stolen money or taken money from various women.
Yeah.
They didn't seem to be so shocked by the physical
No, not at all. They seem to be really complicit in it, actually. There's a really horrible line in it where, which is quoted from one of his friends, who says, how does he phrase it? He says, "Oh, I was used to it. My boys always used to run a lot of girls," and it's just that language, running women.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, okay, there it is. And I think I'd kind of expected that they had been as deceived by him as we had been, but they weren't really. And I'm not convinced that, even when they talk about the lack of the money and the things that he takes from women, I don't know. I wonder why it is that that matters more to them. No, I think I'm still jarred by that bit. I just still don't have an answer for that bit. I'm still very perplexed by it because it's a very difficult situation to kind of suddenly realise that it wasn't just him that was to blame in a way. And then that's, I think, when I realised when I interviewed them that I realised that actually this is... Because originally I wanted to write this as an article. I never expected it to be a book. I thought it would be like maybe a long form article. Mm-hmm. And I think it was after I interviewed them that I suddenly realised that actually this is a much wider societal problem, that this isn't just about like this man doing this thing to this group of women. Mm. And that actually this is a lot more relatable and a much bigger thing, and that there's more to say on this than just him and what he did to us or what his friends knew or didn't know. So
there are some moments in the book where the writing very much, I think, takes off from, as you say, it could have been an article if you had wanted it to be that, but there are some moments when the writing itself really soars because it needs to, and that's why it fits well in a book like this. And it's often when you're talking about moving away from the logic of those men who are sort of disgusted by the fact that he defrauded you from money, and that's not okay. But this thing about bodies, about bodily autonomy, having control of your body, and the impact that he'd had on so many women, it's worth pointing out for those who haven't read the book yet, you were not the only woman that he had been seeing who was basically forced into having an abortion, and that part of his way of behaving was to not wear contraception and to get you into that situation. It's quite hard, I think, for some men to understand why that's such a huge deal. You have an amazing sort of almost like a monologue in the book where you talk about women's bodies. Can you tell me a little bit about why it is so important and some of the ways in which it continued to affect you for a long time after that first, you know, after the abortion, for example?
Around that time when I was living in New York, it was a really recent conversation about how common it was for men to kind of remove contraception without women's consent. And up until that point or around that point, I don't think people really realised that it was illegal. Only soon after it became illegal. Mm. And I think there's a term for it, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's called stealthing. And it's kind of horrifying how common that was. Mm. And the multiple risks of that puts people out, and the fact that just like anything that happens in a sexual encounter, it's like you have to consent to every single aspect of it, including contraception. I think the thing that felt particularly perverse about his what I would consider to be a fascination with getting women pregnant, because I don't think it can happen that many times by accident. I think there has to potentially be something willing there. There's a real, I don't know, to me that it feels like a part of the same sort of form of abuse and degradation. That it's not just about this idea that when you're growing up and you hear it all the time, like, oh, I don't like using a condom, it doesn't feel good. Mm. Well, firstly, tough, and secondly, I don't think sometimes it's just that. I'm not speaking on this person. I'm speaking sort of generally. I think a lot of the time that when men like that want to remove contraception, I think a lot of it comes from a form of power play as well. I don't think it's just about like the enjoyment of it all. Mm. I can only assume in situations like that, it's an understood form of abuse for people. for people who do those things. But yeah, it's probably the hardest part in the book for me. I think even when I was reading the audiobook, that's the only part of the book that I had to take a minute from the recording. Mm. Because I don't cry at any other point in the book when I'm reading it. It's a story to me now. Like I said, a lot of it plays out like a movie. I'm healed from it. But that bit, that part, which I think is about halfway through the memoir, that's always the bit that gets me. That's always the bit that I realise just sort of how vulnerable we are. And I know that it's a book about, I like talking about how powerful we all are, but you can't really talk about how strong we were at the end of it without really talking about how messed up we were through it and before we met each other and came to find each other and went on our own personal healing journeys as well. And I think that part was very painful to write. It was, I don't know if it translates as being as painful when you're reading it, but it's definitely the most painful part for me to read.
I can well imagine it absolutely does translate, because as I say, it sort of feels like a sort of howl of pain as your prose sort of repeats certain phrases.
Yeah.
I think a lot of women, when they're reading the book and even hearing you talk about it, will be nodding in recognition, whereas I think male readers may be surprised to think about some of the things that you talk about. So you mentioned that when you had the abortion, you would normally be going through the process of grieving that whole process, but you weren't allowed to because of his actions. And then again, a year later, your body was still reacting to that abortion that you had had.
Yeah.
You then had a contraceptive implant, and then you then had, when that was taken out, sort of your body is constantly dealing with these things that men don't have to think about.
Yeah.
And that's part of why it has a huge impact for you, mm-hmm. everything that he did, mm-hmm. no matter how small, even if it is, as you say, what they might think of as being a tiny thing, deciding not to wear contraception.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think women's bodies still think that they're pregnant after an abortion or a miscarriage. I think there's several months where the body still thinks it's pregnant, because the hormones haven't, or the hormones are still in your body. So I think, you know, there are lots of cases where women are still putting on what would be considered to be almost like pregnancy weight. Mm. So your body is still kind of going through the motions, and it's a cruel trick. It's a very cruel visual and physiological trick that your body is almost playing on you. And that's hard enough to deal with and process, not just the emotions of it, but physically how much it hurts, how inconvenient it is, how much it hurts to be bleeding that heavily for such a prolonged period of time. It's a lot of strain, a lot of stress on a body. A lot of us and a lot of women outside of this book who've been in similar situations aren't given the opportunity to look after themselves mentally or physically, because now everything has become about the person who's abusing you or abused you or abandoned you. Mm. And they are either you're still having to take care of them, or you're having to grieve what they've done to you rather than grieve or process what's happening to your own body.
Mm. Bringing it back to those women, as you say, the relationships that you were able to build together and that strength that you found together, which is, of course, the chain that gives the book its title. Tell me a little bit about, not so much about we know why those links were made, but whether there's something unique about the way women speak to each other and share things that allows them to make a connection like that, and why that connection is so powerful.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I said a bit before, I think I touched on it, I think it's because a lot of the time we're not convinced that we have anyone else to help us. I think a lot of the time it's also because women are brought up in, I mean, I'm very lucky I didn't have this with my household, but I think a lot of families don't necessarily give space to girls to talk about starting their periods, maybe, or fancying people, or sexuality, or masturbation, or what is abuse and what isn't, you know? So we kind of seek out other people or other women or older women that you can speak to, or the older girls at school that can help you? Or, I mean, I went to an all-girls school. It was a state school. It was quite rough. And I learned all of my street smarts from there. Mm. Like, the one thing that we all knew was, it didn't matter what race you were, it didn't matter what size you were, it didn't matter what religion you were, what class you were. You never got picked on for any of those things. You get smacked in the face if you, like, go after someone else's boyfriend. You know, those were the things. It was like, there was that, like, you don't disrespect someone on a personal level.
Yeah.
But the second somebody tried to bully someone or tried to kind of come for them for something else, everyone was like, no, you don't speak to someone like that. You don't do that. You stand up for other people. But it was like, you just don't you don't disrespect each other on a personal level. But beyond that, it was like you still had this sense of community. And I remember, you know, if you didn't, I remember I had this. I didn't know how to shave. I was like 12 or 13. I had hairy legs. I didn't know how to shave them. Mm. I don't think it's important whether you do or you don't now. But at the time, it was. I didn't know what to do. It never really occurred to me to even go. If I'd asked my mum, she would have helped. But it didn't even really occur to me. But it was the older girls at school that kind of, that will tell you or take you aside or be like, oh, if you're interested in that, without shaming you. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't a necessity, but it was those conversations were just constantly being had. And it was, I think it's because a lot of people, we don't necessarily see that support for girls and for women in wider society. I hope it's changing now, I'm not quite sure. But I think that's a huge part of the reason why we have this kind of innate intuitive chain, essentially, that we're constantly passing down our wisdom and our information and how to be safe or stay safe or have a nice time even.
Mm. I mean, I suppose it's very easy to say, only women talk this way and men don't talk to each other. And I think that's probably not the case now. Maybe things are improving. Men do talk to each other more.
Absolutely.
But you do make clear in the book that in this case, you know, these friends were not talking to each other about, or certainly not talking to other women about the behaviour of this man. And I think that there was also a Daniel Sloss comedy routine that came up again recently where he was talking about culpability.
Yeah.
That if one of your friends is behaving in a certain way and you don't do anything about it, then you're guilty.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I mean, I think men, my male friends are really good at talking to each other about stuff and talking to women and listening and taking accountability. And I think it is changing. But yes, definitely when I was growing up, there was much less of that.
Mm.
And it's why we talk so much about how important it is for men to get, you know, mental health treatment as well, and why that has become a crisis or has been a crisis for a really long time.
Mm.
I think it's also, whilst I love the chain, this connection that we have with each other, it's also really exhausting.
Mm.
And I think, yes, it is important that, like, when men see that men also step in, that men also say, no, that's not okay, that men start educating. It's like, I can't spend my life as a woman educating people for free in what should be my luxury time or what should be like my relaxation time.
Mm.
I don't go to the pub so that I can, you know, be the superhero for every woman in there. Like, I'd like to have a drink and unwind at the end of the day or see my friends, and everyone has a right to do that. And I think that's where it becomes important for everybody to start playing a role in that, and for men to take their friends aside and be like, that's not cool, because unfortunately there are a lot of times when men also don't listen to women, and that's another problem. But until we get to that point, if there are some guys that only are going to listen to their guy friends or their dads, then their guy friends and their dads have to step up.
You've mentioned that writing this sort of started as a smaller idea and became a much bigger idea with the book. What do you hope that readers might take away from reading The Chain?
Just peace, I think. I think it offered me so much peace writing it. It offered me so much. I've never really agreed with the idea that, like, writing should be therapy or should always be treated as therapy. I think there's more to it than that. But at the same time, it did offer me a huge solace, and that's what I want readers to get from it. Like, of course I want it to be educational to those people from us, people who haven't experienced those things. It doesn't have to be men. I think a lot of women aren't necessarily privy to that, to abuse or surviving abuse. Some people don't have their own chain. I'd like everyone to have their own chain, including men. But yeah, I'd like people to find peace of mind, and I'd like people to, if they're in an abusive relationship or if they're in a relationship that's affecting them really negatively, and that there's no positive way out of it, or through it rather, to find the strength enough to leave, and to find the strength enough to seek out their own chain, their own network of people to look after them and help them and be there for them through it. And if they've been through all of that and they're blaming themselves for it, or they don't know how to piece together the traumatic things that have happened to them in their past relationships, hopefully this can offer some kind of peace to them where they're not blaming themselves.
I'm always grateful to authors for giving me the time to talk to them about their books, but given how difficult the subject matter of this book is, Shimon, I'm particularly grateful to you. So
thank you so much. Oh, that's really kind. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.